I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Associated Press is estimating that as many as 200,000 Ukrainians are massing on the streets of Kiev, vowing to stay there until their reform candidate in Sunday's close election is named president. Ukraine is a former member of the Soviet Union and now an independent country, torn between its allegiance to Russia on one border and the pull of European democracy on the other. Joining us is Tom Warner. He's correspondent for the Financial Times. He's based in Kiev. And Tom, the populace seems to be as divided as the country is geographically.
The populace is very much divided between the central and western regions of Ukraine and the eastern and southern regions. The center and west are more pulled towards European democracy, as you were saying, whereas the eastern and southern parts of Ukraine are mostly Russian-speaking and more tied to Russia by culture and political ideology, I'd say.
And Russia's favorite candidate was the prime minister, Yanukovych, whereas Yushchenko is the reformist challenger, and that was a very tight election.
I would say it was. I mean, the official count in the first round, they gave Yushchenko officially a 0.5% lead, and that's probably closer to the real sympathies of the people, although I think even, you know, there were a lot of allegations that even the first round was subject to serious falsification. And the second round, there are, you know, allegations of much larger falsification.
And what are people in the streets in Kiev saying?
They're saying that this is their best chance to have a truly independent Ukraine. They feel that the post-Soviet Ukrainian government isn't it really under their control and is too dependent on Russia. And they're saying that this is a real opportunity to have a democratic country.
Well, in fact, we should say that this time, while Russia is backing the prime minister, the U.S. and much of the West is backing the challenger.
They're backing him in the sense that they're backing a review of the official electoral results. They're backing his claims that there were serious irregularities in the voting process, a lot of suspicious votes being counted, a lot of very suspiciously high turnout in eastern regions.
But Tom Warner, tell us, some experts in the region are saying that the Ukraine has become the object of a new geopolitical struggle between Russia and the West. How serious is this, both externally and internally? Is there a fear of civil war?
I think that to a certain extent there is, but it's also to a certain extent a bluff on the part of the government. They've been using that kind of threat as propaganda to scare people to vote for the government. I think that the eastern people are not going to come out into the streets, and they aren't coming out into the streets in support of their candidate to the extent that the central and western Ukrainians are.
Well, how volatile are things in the street there, Tom? Is there a sense that if the government decides to crack down or refuses to consider Yushchenko the opposition candidate as the winner, what will those people in the streets do?
My sense is that they're ready. You know, they can't be ready for a really full-scale attack, and it's hard to say how hard the government would crack down. My sense is that until the government understood how big the crowds are, they expected to be able to just crack down on the protests, and they've said all along that that's what they intended to do. Really, everyone's been talking about this possibility. Everyone saw how things happened in Georgia, and there's been a whole lot of discussion of a so-called Georgian scenario, for months before the elections. And now that it's materialized, the government's not sure what to do, because it's not just 200,000 people in the streets of Kiev. It's millions of people all around the central and western parts of Ukraine who are openly wearing orange color to show their public support, and it's among the sort of armies of public officials, even, who are supposed to make this regime work.
And we should remind people that Georgia saw a bloodless revolution a year ago.
A year ago.
Yeah, and some of the following. And obviously, you find that interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of curious. It was exactly a year ago today that Edward Shevardnadze resigned.
Tom Warner, Kiev correspondent for the Financial Times, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A federal judge in Georgia is expected to rule soon on a case about stickers that were placed inside biology textbooks in suburban Atlanta. The disclaimers read, "This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered." Well, the Georgia case is one of several challenging the teachings of evolution, reflecting perhaps that according to a 2001 Gallup poll, 48% of Americans surveyed believed in the biblical version of creation. Raja Mishra of the Boston Globe has covered the story. He joins us in the studio. And Raja, you write, "Evolution is considered by scientists to be among the most important and supported scientific theory of all time." So first, just a brief reminder, evolution is what?
Well, evolution at its root is the notion that life evolved from simple single-cell organisms to very complicated human beings with brains through a long, drawn-out process in which random genetic mutations created traits that allowed certain species to survive and outlast other species, which died off. And that's how life evolved.
Nowhere in the disclaimers that are in the books in Georgia and are being contested do you see the word creationism? But remind us first, what is creationism?
Well, creationism is basically the literal acceptance of the book of Genesis, which is that, you know, God created everything in a set amount of days, and that sort of explains how everything got here, how life got here, how humans got here. It's an explicitly religious viewpoint.
Well, Raja, as you write, in 1987, the Supreme Court ruled that teaching creationism in public schools violated the separation between church and state. So do you think that those who are against evolution, pro-creationism, are conscious of that in this new tactic?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it's not just the suburban Atlanta case, but in most of the cases that I write about or other cases that have taken place in the last few years, there's no mention of God. There's no mention of Jesus. There's no mention of the Bible. So they are very careful about it. Rather, it's sort of cloaked in this guise of being skeptical from a scientific point of view, being skeptical of evolution.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, this debate has been going on, well, it's been almost 80 years since John Scopes, a substitute teacher in Tennessee, was arrested and tried for teaching evolution. It was the famous Scopes monkey trial.
Right.
Because of the movie, some people think Spencer Tracy tried that case. But it took another 40 years to get that anti-evolution law off the books in Tennessee. In 1999, the issue came back on the national radar when the Kansas Board of Education voted to remove evolution from the curriculum. What else is different? Now, you just alluded to something, but what else is different about the anti-evolution forces now?
They know the Supreme Court decision is out there. They know that a large swath of America is wary of too much involvement of church and state. And so it's presented as sort of almost a scientific skepticism, as, you know, evolution is a theory, which it is, and there are disagreements within the theory, which there are, and therefore, and this is sort of the leap that they make, therefore, people should be kind of skeptical of it because it's not a hard and, you know, it's not a definitive theory such as those in physics, which can be proved over and over and over. Rather, it's something about the past. And one thing, you know, you asked about recent changes in this movement. The internet has played a big role. It sort of helped them organize, disseminate literature. You know, various sort of dissident scientists have put together sort of briefs allowing advocates of this position to make arguments in local school boards, sort of presenting, you know, these are the disagreements within evolutionary theory. These are, you know, some of the gaps in it. And it sort of gives allows local people who might not be as fluent in biology and science to make sort of compelling sounding arguments at the local level.
We're going to be talking in a moment with an author of a book that's sold at the federally funded Grand Canyon bookstores that supports the creationist theory of how the Grand Canyon was made. It's called The Young Earth Theory, you know, that the Earth is maybe only about 6,000 years old. Most scientists
right.
say it's billions of years old. That's one of their theories, Young Earth Theory. Another that we're hearing about is intelligent design theory.
Right. Intelligent design theory, and this is a favorite of a lot of the people challenging evolution in the schools. And that states that human beings are very complex, so complex that random mutations can't explain them. And they suggest that the complexity of human life implies an intelligent designer, somebody or something or some force that sort of thought through the design and put it that way.
Well, back to the Georgia case, school board members in Cobb County approved the disclaimer that's in the books now saying that evolution is only one theory. They approved that in 2002 after a devout Christian said that she wanted it in her son's textbook. Then six local parents challenged that decision, arguing that the disclaimer violates constitutional provisions separating church and state. How is the court expected to rule on this?
It's really interesting. It's not a clear-cut case because, as you mentioned, there's nowhere does God enter into the picture. Nowhere does the book of Genesis or creationism enter into the picture. So one of the threshold questions that this federal judge has to answer is intelligent design, which is one of the arguments that the advocates of the disclaimer are making, does that cross the line into religion? Does evolutionary skepticism cross the line into a sort of a religious point of view?
Well, you write the challenges to teaching evolution are underway in 13 states. Pennsylvania had a school board pass a measure requiring teachers to teach intelligent design. And a Maryland school board is debating eliminating all textbooks that are biased, as they say, biased towards evolution. Some are saying that this whole review process is happening now because of the No Child Left Behind statute, which requires that states review curriculum.
Right. I mean, I think the movement has been gathering steam for the last couple of years, but they really see an opening with the No Child Left Behind, that which sort of sets federal standards for state education programs, and that includes the mandate to review science curriculum. And when you review something, of course, you have the options of changing it, and therefore mm-hmm. political pressure can be applied at the local level where these reviews take place, and school boards and boards of education and so on.
Well, Raja, I know you got a lot of emails about your story. What are people saying to you?
The creationist side, I've gotten a lot of screeds explaining their sort of argument. You know, a lot of them very similar, sort of indicating the amount of collaborating and disseminating of their various papers and studies. I mean, they've got a whole body of literature. They have papers that are printed in sort of pseudo journals and that kind of a thing. And there are scientists who are part of this movement now. So I've gotten their point of view, but I've also gotten a lot of, more people locally, more of our readers. I mean, my article has been republished in other newspapers, so I'm hearing from people around the country. But as far as from around here, it's been overwhelmingly like, I can't believe these people are still around. Or the more intense reply is, how can you even take these people seriously? Even when you say the vast majority of scientists support evolution, people have said that's even understating it.
Well, but why do you take them seriously? Why did you write so much about this?
It's sprouting up in so many different states, and there's clearly momentum behind it, and it is impacting curriculum. I mean, obviously, a number of these measures have already been passed. Textbooks are changing.
Right.
Classroom discussion is changing, and so that's news.
Raja Mishra covers health and science for the Boston Globe. Raja, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us.
My pleasure.
And in a minute, we're going to speak with Tom Vail. He's the author and professional river guide in Arizona, whose book on the creationist view of the Grand Canyon is being sold in the government-backed bookstores there. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as we just heard, the debate between evolutionists and creationists is being played out in schools. It's also being played out at the Grand Canyon National Park. A book called Grand Canyon, A Different View, is being sold in the park's bookstores. It reflects the young earth theory of creationism, that is, that the earth is 6,000 years old. Well, critics say a faith-based book should not be sold in federally funded bookstores. And Elaine Seavey, a spokesperson with the National Park System, told us in a written statement that government attorneys are reviewing the matter, but also that our nation values freedom of speech and freedom of religion. Because park bookstores carry books presenting a variety of ideas and perspectives, it does not mean the park system endorses those viewpoints any more than a public library endorses all the views of the books it contains. Well, Tom Vail is the book's author and a rafting guide who runs Canyon Ministries in Phoenix, Arizona, rafting trips with a creationist point of view. And I asked Vail to explain his view of the Grand Canyon.
Well, the Bible tells us that the earth, based on the lineages laid out in the Bible, is about 6,000 years old. And again, by what we see in the Bible, the biblical flood comes about 1,500 years later. And the Grand Canyon gets formed after the receding of the flood. Some scientists believe that it was formed as part of the receding of the flood. Most believe that it was carved by the breaching of some very large landlocked lakes that were left after the receding of the flood that carved the canyon very quickly, probably in a matter of just days.
Well, we've agreed not to debate the science, but as you know, all other scientists overwhelmingly agree that the canyon was formed billions of years ago, that there's a preponderance of geological evidence against creationist theory.
There is a lot of material out there that is looked at from an evolutionary point of view, but there is no physical evidence to support it. We've got to understand that we're looking at Earth's history, and nobody was there when this all came about.
So you're comfortable saying they're all wrong?
Yeah.
How do you lay this theory out in your book? What does it look like?
Well, the book is physically sort of a coffee table type of book. I write an introduction to each section, and then there are contributions from 23 different people from across the country and actually from around the world that lay out from their perspective, and most of these are scientists, how what we see in the real world supports what we read in God's Word.
Tom, I'm wondering, would any argument that any scientist made matter to you? In other words, if they were to lay out the geology, the radiometrics, if they were to show you that your theory was impossible, would that practical science matter to you? Since I assume you believe that God can do miracles.
Well, yes. I mean, if God was able to create the world in six literal days, then that pretty much leaves him capable of doing anything. What we do find in the Grand Canyon, when you look at it from a biblical worldview, doesn't refute anything we read in the Bible. And the science that we see in the Grand Canyon, when looked at from a biblical perspective, matches up with what we read in the Bible.
Give me some examples.
Yeah, I'm not a scientist, okay? But there are 17 scientists, 14 of whom have PhDs in their respective fields that are contributors to this book that all have done research in the Grand Canyon. And their science, because of their worldview, and therefore their initial perspective, comes to a different conclusion than what an evolutionary scientist would come to.
We know that all of these scientists that you're speaking of are creationist scientists.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you didn't always hold their view.
That's correct. When I initially started in the canyon, I was not a believer in Christ, and I taught the evolutionary model of how the canyon was formed, slower particle at a time deposition over millions of years. When I accepted Christ, my worldview changed, and I started looking at the canyon from a different perspective. And when I started looking at the science that correlates to that perspective, what I found was a model of the formation of the canyon that made more sense to me than the evolutionary model. Dr. John Morris has a quote in the book. It says, "If I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it." And so when you look at the Grand Canyon, if you go into the canyon assuming to find millions of years of data, that's what you're going to find. But if you go into it with a biblical worldview, which includes the global flood of Noah's day, what you're going to see is classic flood geology just on a very, very large scale.
Well, right now your book is sold in the National Park bookstores in the Grand Canyon. That is raising a lot of questions. As you know, you've just said you're not a scientist, and this is a faith-based, Bible-based theory. Don't you think, given that we're supposed to have separation of church and state, a faith-based book written by a non-scientist about the creation of the Grand Canyon shouldn't be sold in a bookstore there?
I'm not a scientist, but there are 17 scientists that have contributed to the book.
And they're all creationist scientists.
They're all creation scientists, correct. Mm-hmm. Why should their view, just because it doesn't agree with everybody else's, be censored?
Well, your critics say it's because there's certain accepted fact. It's supported by a preponderance of evidence, and that's how it's decided what taxpayer dollars support, that faith is intensely personal and shouldn't be publicly supported. What if someone came along and decided that their scientists discovered that Martians created the Grand Canyon, and they wanted a book sold saying that?
Well, there are books that in the bookstores that lay out the Native American beliefs of how the canyon was formed. But the point is, there is science behind this. Okay? This is valid science. It just doesn't happen to agree with, as you said, the preponderance of the people out there. It doesn't make it wrong.
Tom Vail, author of the book Grand Canyon, A Different View. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Over 1,000 military personnel from the U.S. have been killed in Iraq to date. Here's one man's story. Lance Corporal Dimitrios Gavriel was killed on Friday in combat near Fallujah. The 29-year-old, known as Dimmy, went to high school in New Hampshire and attended Brown University in Rhode Island before working as an investment banker on Wall Street. After he lost two friends in the attacks of September 11th, he decided to join the Marines. Gabriel's parents now live in Massachusetts. His mother, Penelope, told Here and Now's Bob Oakes that Dimitrios was a born leader.
He was a very idealistic person. He believed in integrity, leading by example, honesty. He was always mentoring people to do the right things. Ever since he was in high school, he was one of the youngest captains in his wrestling team. Then after his college years and when he joined the working people ranks, he realized that the world is a lot different than what he imagined it to be. And especially working on Wall Street, he felt as if he was swimming in a sea with sharks. And then it was September 11. During that tragic incident, he lost two of his best friends. And that emboldened his belief that that is really what he has to do, that he needs to enlist, go serve his country, give back to his country a little bit of what he can. And also, he felt like many young men and women who joined after September 11 that this was a calling for them.
When you first learned that he was thinking about enlisting, you tried to discourage him. Why?
We did. We were very concerned, as I said, about his safety. We were hearing a lot of bad things about the wars and how it was conducted, especially the war in Iraq. In addition, I had some experience in my life of similar nature. My brother, he served in the Greek army. He was killed during an exercise from friendly fire. And also my son had his name. And incidentally, my brother got killed in November, 32 years ago. So all that, you know, call it intuition, call it fear, call it the instinct, maternal instinct, something told me he shouldn't be there, he shouldn't go.
What made you decide you had to let him go?
It wasn't a matter of a decision of our behalf. The only role we played at that moment was just bless him and let him go. And he felt that he told one of his friends, I could not go on living my life until I had to go through this. He enlisted last year, October 23rd. He did boot camp for 3 months and then went to Camp Lejeune, where he was based. After a couple of drills in urban warfare, they readied them for Iraq, and they left. They were deployed June 23rd of 2004.
What do you know about his duty in Iraq? Did he seem concerned?
Not at all. Because we knew we were very concerned about his safety from conversations and questions we were asking him, every time we communicated with him, and there was very little live communication, probably 2-3 phone calls, everything is great, I'm in good shape, I'm eating well, I'm healthy, the weather is getting nice now, it's not as hot, we acclimated ourselves. When they went there, it was as hot as 140 degrees. Don't worry about me, I'm in great shape, and I'm looking forward to finish the job we have to do here and come back home.
He was a gung-ho guy, a real Marine. He was interviewed by the New York Times just a few months back, and he was quoted as saying, we're locked, cocked, and ready to rock.
And ready to rock.
That's about how we feel.
And that's who he was. He wasn't, though, as the polemic or warmonger as he may sound from these words. He was a lot softer than that. The Marines, though, are a tough corps, and you cannot act softly. You need to talk boldly and act boldly. Inside, he was a very loving, soft giant, and he had very many ways that he demonstrated that among, his friends and his family.
He told a friend of his, a former roommate at Brown University, that he was concerned about his legacy. And I know it might be a little early to think about this, but what do you think his legacy is?
I think the way circumstances brought it, I think he's going to have the best legacy that he would ever dreamed of. At what price, though? He wanted to be remembered as somebody who never backed off out of a difficult moment, fearless and always striving for the hardest and the he wanted to be challenged, always.
Mrs. Gavrielle, I'm sure there are folks who are listening to us talk who wonder how you have the strength to do this at this time, and so eloquently, I might add. But I know that part of the reason you want to talk to us and to other reporters is that you want Dimmy to be remembered as a role model for other children.
Exactly. With these interviews and meetings we have with media, we like to convey to the youth primarily of this country that bravery is not an advantage. It's something that everybody can do. You can always be brave, love your country, be a good person, and achieve high in life if you wanted to.
Penelope Gavrielle, I'm sure that I speak for most everyone who's listening when I say thank you so very much for speaking with us, and we're very sorry for your loss.
I thank you, too, and we are grieving for his loss, but he was another good man of the many who were lost in this cause.
Penelope Gavrielle speaking with Here Now's Bob Oakes about her son, Marine Lance Corporal Dimitrios Gavrielle, who was killed in Iraq last Friday. His family plans to bury Dimitrios at Arlington National Cemetery, and Mrs. Gavrielle shared with us a poem by her son. He wrote it soon after September 11th. It's read now by Here Now's Sean Cole.
How will words of beauty sprout root on deafened ears when so many choose to follow and so few dare to lead? Forsaken dreams lie prisoners in vapid minds left blank of countless breathing numbers lined up along the track. And then there are the dreamers who see beyond the shroud. Distinct are they among us, they shuffle through the crowd. Hope lives among so few, yet strong it is, I know, for I am still a dreamer, along the track I go.
That poem written by the late Marine Lance Corporal Dimitrios Gavriel. A scholarship in Gavriel's honor has been established at his alma mater, Timberland High School in Plaistow, New Hampshire. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, according to the Butterball Turkey Hotline, 45 million birds are consumed on Thanksgiving, and most of them are produced by large turkey manufacturers. Well, sorry to put a damper on your upcoming dinner, but most of those so-called broad-breasted whites are too fat to walk, are kept awake round the clock and force-fed, are stuffed with antibiotics, and every natural instinct and taste has been bred out of them. In fact, processors often shoot the packaged product up with oils to make it more palatable. Happy Thanksgiving indeed. But there is a movement of farmers and foodies to encourage Americans to try a different kind of turkey, a pre-industrial variety called an heirloom, a thinner turkey that might be key to the survival of the whole species. Judy Adams raises heirloom turkeys in northern Vermont. Judy, tell us first of all, what are heirlooms?
Heirloom turkeys are the turkeys that maybe your grandparents or my great-grandparents actually dined on for their Thanksgiving feast. These are turkeys that are actually native to the United States.
They do what turkeys naturally like to do. They roam around and eat insects and other things?
Exactly. They're a lively bird. They can fly. We raise the Bourbon Reds here at Adams Turkey Farms. They like to pick and socialize and eat bugs and do everything naturally a turkey would do.
And we're talking about birds that make their way to somebody's dinner table, which, you know, some people object to, but the fact is that they will taste better once they get there because of their lives.
The Bourbon Red is, I think, and I've heard it from other people, one of the most flavorful turkeys of the heirloom turkey breeds, or heirloom or heritage turkey breeds. We've raised them for 3 years now, and we have had customers that are calling us right after Thanksgiving to place their order for the next year.
But what's the importance of the heirlooms in the species?
It's very important. These turkeys are a part of our American heritage. There's been a movement away from the older breeds of turkeys, and now through greater awareness, there's been a movement to bring back or make people aware that, hey, these birds, their genetic diversity is extremely important to save from its extinction.
Because we understand that most Americans, when you buy a bird normally just at a regular supermarket, it's usually the broad-breasted white turkey, which hardly is, the poor thing is hardly an animal anymore. It's created by artificial insemination. It's bred in factories in most cases. Its beaks and toenails are removed. It's not allowed to sleep at all.
A lot of these turkeys, they are designed to produce meat in a short amount of time, the broad-breasted whites, and they do that very well. Unfortunately, with the large factory farms in the United States, these birds are pushed to their limit. Because of that, we've lost sight of what a Thanksgiving turkey really was and perhaps should be. And that's just a symbol of thanks. It doesn't necessarily have to be the biggest and the best and the meatiest turkey.
Well, we know that the heirlooms are not only rare, but the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy considers them endangered. So with that in mind, do you have any doubts about selling them at all?
No, I don't. We want people to consume these turkeys because that way the hatcheries will continue to hatch these birds, the growers will continue to grow them, and people can continue to enjoy them. Because if people don't eat them, I know it doesn't sound very good, but we need to continue that cycle in order to save these breeds. And I believe awareness is growing. There's some rays of hope for these heritage breeds of animals.
Any chance of someone getting an heirloom turkey from you this year?
Well, My husband always keeps what he calls his secret stash. So if you happen to call and talk to him and say the right things, there might be a chance there's an heirloom turkey available from Adams Turkey Farm. But in general, I'd say demand has been extremely strong, and we are sold out.
Judy Adams raises heirloom turkeys in northern Vermont. Judy, thank you.
Thank you.
And for more information on heirloom turkeys, go quickly to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Libraries are places of quiet and learning. Here is where people one frequently finds lower their voices and raise their minds, wrote Richard R. Moore in 1954. But there are libraries that have a dramatic story to tell, not just in their books, but in their founding. The Widener Library at Harvard University is one such place. Widener, Biography of a Library, has just been published, and it tells of a titanic tale hidden among the shelves, like the boat. Here Now's Michael Goldfarb met Matthew Battles on the steps of the library. Battles is author of the Widener book and editor of the Harvard Library Bulletin. The library has just been refurbished at a cost of $90 million.
Matt, hi.
Hi there.
Here we are. Beaux-Art meets Puritan architecture. Big, ornate, neoclassical columns, but because it's Harvard, you've got to have a lot of red brick.
You've
got to
have the brick, yeah. And in the 20th century heyday of the Ivy League, this building was covered with ivy as well.
Why did they trim the ivy off?
They were concerned about the effect of the ivy on the bricks. We're trying to preserve the bricks now.
Right. Let's go inside.
Sure.
You walk into a splendid space, more columns, and a grand staircase. Your eye is drawn up through the library's freshly cleaned, gleaming marble to a room beyond the staircase landing. A portrait of an angelic-looking young man in his mid-20s looks back at you. It's the man for whom the library is named, Harry Elkins Widener.
This space that we're walking through right now is the Rotunda and the Widener Memorial Room.
And then you come into this wood-paneled library where the benefactor is seated for a portrait over a marble fireplace. His right hand is delicately brushing his jawline as he contemplates whatever it is he's reading in that wonderful book.
Mm-hmm.
And he is sort of like the local deity.
Yes, he is indeed. He's the sort of household god of Widener in a way.
It's funny. Every time I come into the library, the song, "They Built the Ship Titanic to Sail the Ocean Blue," goes through my head.
Yeah,
tell us the story of actually how this library came into being.
Sure, sure. Well, Harry was a Harvard graduate, and as a young man moving into his family's business, collected these books you see around us. With his family, he took a trip to Europe and had booked return passage on the Titanic. And when the Titanic went down, Harry and his father went down with it. His mother shared a lifeboat with Lady Astor, and on her return, looked for a way to memorialize Harry. And so Mrs. Widener came along saying she would like to build a small library on Harvard Yard for her son's books. And the new president at the time, A. Lawrence Lowell, convinced her to instead endow this massive library with her son's library at the heart of it. And Mrs. Widener, in fact, throughout the rest of her life, continued to buy books for this collection. In a sense, she felt she was continuing to buy books for Harry.
Although at that point, she would have been one of the very few women allowed to use this library, right?
Oh, absolutely. It was very difficult for women to come to the library. And in fact, she received numerous complaints from women scholars, some of whom were quite senior. Women could enter the building during daylight hours. There was a separate reading room set aside for Radcliffe students. It was about, well, it was essentially a large broom closet. It was very difficult for a woman to find a restroom in Widener when it first opened. This is an interesting space, too, because there were several book thefts in Widener throughout its history, and probably the most interesting and important one happened here. It was an attempted theft of the Gutenberg Bible, which had been purchased by the Widener family following Harry's death. He'd always wanted to get one, but hadn't gotten around to it. And in 1969, a young man, Vito Arras, came into the building, and he hid himself in an upstairs restroom, and after hours, broke in and snatched the Gutenberg Bible put it in his backpack, and then started out the window, but fell. People like to say that the Bible actually saved him because he landed on it. He broke his leg rather badly, but could have been hurt much worse. He fell, I think, 3 stories and was found thrashing about by a night watchman.
Flanking the entrance to the rotunda are 2 paintings by John Singer Sargent in honor of Harvard men killed on the battlefields of World War I. It's a reminder that this building is a product of a particular moment in American history. The end of the Gilded Age, symbolized by the sinking of the Titanic, followed almost immediately by the Great War and the emergence of the United States as a global power.
You know, this library comes along at just the moment at which Harvard and higher education in America are undergoing this profound transformation, moving from a kind of plutocratic ideal to the meritocratic ideal for university that we're familiar with now.
From the gleaming marble of the public room, Matthew led me down and down and down into the heart of any library, the stacks.
We're on sea level in the stacks of Widener Library, 2nd of 10 levels. This is my favorite area because this is where books about books are shelved, so it's where I've spent a lot of my time.
Well, the smell is absolutely right. dust and mildew. How many books are stored in the stacks?
Right now we have about 2.5 million books in the stacks and another 3 million or so in a depository off-site. That's just part of Harvard College's collections, which are also in many other libraries around the campus and elsewhere.
Who really uses these 5.5 million books? Mm-hmm. Is it the undergraduates, or is it the scholars who make their lives working in this brick-colored ivory tower?
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting question because Widener was, again, built on the cusp of a change in how books were used. In the 19th century, scholars were supposed to have all the books they needed themselves, more or less. But there was a professionalization of the professoriate in the early 20th century, men and women who were coming from all kinds of backgrounds, more than ever before, and weren't building their own libraries, but needed access to resources that the university could marshal in a kind of unprecedented way.
Now, this library has just been refitted. Mm-hmm. It looks great. Mm-hmm. But we all do most of our research now through Google. You know, how much longer will libraries of this size and scale have a useful purpose?
One of the things that's interesting about the renovation is that an attempt has been made to mediate this divide between new ways of coming in contact with information and these objects in the stacks. The new facilities that have been installed in the library, incorporating technology and new ways of accessing information, make a very interesting fit with the research collections of old. The library also has a role to play as a kind of preserver of the collective memory.
It is really a glorious interior and a very important part of, you know, the Boston metropolitan area's architectural heritage. Mm-hmm. So why isn't the public allowed in from time to time?
Well, the stated reason is that it's a research institution in which students and scholars are busily at work in reading rooms throughout the building and liable to be disturbed by the public moving through. Now, that has not always been the case. The public has been able to enter the building at other times in its history. When Widener first opened, there weren't such things as Harvard ID cards. You walked into the library and made what use of it you could and would. And so people came from all throughout the community. That's indeed how somebody like Vito Arras managed to get inside and find a bathroom to secret himself inside, which is part of the reason why this closing has taken place over the decades. Personally, I would like to see this building shared with the public at large.
Matthew, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Well, in the meantime, we got to go in with Michael. Michael Goldfarb talking with Matthew Battles, the author of Widener, Biography of a Library, published this month by Harvard University Press. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.